Doctor, Nelson said, I saw this patient only 10 days ago. Tell me where he got those muscles.
Why, he sent in a coupon from Rut, the magazine for He-Man. You know the ad that tells how a 90-pound weakling can...
Doctor, please.
Why not ask him?
Nelson did so. I thanked them, Mike answered.
That's right, Jubal agreed. He thanked them. When I got him last week, he was a mess, slight, flabby, and pale. Looked as if he'd been raised in a cave. I gather he was. So I told him to grow strong. He did.
Exercises? Nelson said doubtfully.
Some swimming.
A few days swimming won't make a man look as if he had been sweating over barbells for years?
Nelson frowned.
I know Mike has control of the so-called involuntary muscles, but that has precedent. This, however, requires one to assume...
Doctor, Jubal said gently. Why not admit you don't grok it?
Nelson sighed.
I might as well. Put on your clothes, Michael.
Later, Jubal unburdened himself privately to the three officers of the Champion. The financial end was simple. Just tie up Mike's money so that a struggle couldn't take place. Not even if he dies, because I've told Douglas that Mike's death ends his stewardship, whereas a rumor from a usually reliable source, me, has reached Kung and others, that Mike's death gives Douglas permanent control. Of course, if I had magic powers, I would have stripped the boy of every penny. That...
Why, Jubal?
The captain interrupted. Harshaw stared.
Are you wealthy, Skipper? I mean rich?
Me?
Van Tromp snorted.
I've my salary, a pension someday, a mortgaged house, and 2 girls in college. I'd like to be wealthy.
You wouldn't like it.
Ha! You wouldn't say that if you had daughters in school.
I put 4 through college, and went in debt to my armpits. One is a star in her profession, under her married name because I'm an old bum instead of a revered memory. The others remember my birthday and don't bother me. Education didn't harm them. I mention my offspring only to prove that I know that a father often needs more than he has. But you can go with some firm that will pay you several times what you're getting just for your name on the letterhead. You've had offers?
That's beside the point, Captain Van Tromp answered stiffly. I'm a professional man,
meaning that money can't tempt you into giving up commanding spaceships.
I wouldn't mind having money, too.
A little is no good. Daughters can spend 10% more than a man can make in any usual occupation. That's the law of nature, to be known henceforth as Harshaw's law. But, Captain,
real
wealth, on the scale that calls for a battery of finaglers to hold down taxes, would ground you as certainly as resigning would.
Nonsense. I'd put it in the bonds and just clip coupons.
Not if you were the type who acquires great wealth in the first place.
Big money isn't hard to come by.
All it costs is a lifetime of devotion. But no ballerina ever works harder. Captain, that's not your style. You don't want to make money. You simply want to spend money.
Correct, sir. So I can't see why you would want to take Mike's wealth away from him.
Because great wealth is a curse. Unless you enjoy money-making for its own sake. Even then it has serious drawbacks.
Oh, piffle, Jubal, you talk like a harem guard trying to sell a whole man on the advantages of being a eunuch.
Possibly, agreed Jubal. The mind's ability to rationalize its own shortcomings is unlimited. I am no exception. Since I, like yourself, sir, have no interest in money other than to spend it, it is impossible for me to get rich. Conversely, there's never been any danger that I would fail to scrounge the modest amount needed to feed my vices, since anyone with the savvy not to draw to a small pair can do that. But great wealth...
You saw that farce.
Could I have rewritten it so that I acquired the plunder, become its manager and de facto owner while milking off any income I coveted, and still have rigged it so that Douglas would have supported the outcome?
Mike, trust me. I am his water brother.
Could I have stolen his fortune?
Damn you, Jubal, I suppose so.
A certainty. 'Cause our Secretary General is no more a money seeker than you are. His drive is power. A drum whose beat I do not hear. Had I guaranteed, oh, gracefully, that the Smith estate would continue to bulwark his administration, then I would have been left with the boodle.
Jubal shuddered.
I thought I was going to have to do that, to protect Mike from vultures, and I was panic-stricken.
Captain, you don't know what an old man of the sea great wealth is. Its owner is beset on every side, like beggars in Bombay, each demanding that he invest or give away part of his wealth. He becomes suspicious. Honest friendship is rarely offered him.
Those who could have been friends are too fastidious to be jostled by beggars, too proud to risk being mistaken for one. Worse yet, his family is always in danger. Captain, have your daughters ever been threatened with kidnapping?
What? Good Lord, no.
If you possessed the wealth Mike had thrust on him, you would have those girls guarded night and day. Still, you would not rest because you would never be sure of the guards. Look at the last 100 or so kidnappings and note how many involved a trusted employee. And how few victims escaped alive. Is there anything money can buy which is worth having your daughter's necks in a noose?
Van Tromp looked thoughtful.
I'll keep my mortgaged house, Jubal.
Amen. I want to live my own life, sleep in my own bed, and not be bothered. Yet I thought I was going to be forced to spend my last years in an office, barricaded by buffers, working long hours, as Mike's man of business. Then I had an inspiration. Douglas lives behind such barricades, has such a staff. Since we were surrendering the power to ensure Mike's freedom, why not make Douglas pay by assuming the headaches? I was not afraid that he would steal. Only second-rate politicians are money-hungry, and Douglas is no pipsqueak. Quit scowling, Ben, and hope that he never dumps the load on you. So I dumped it on Douglas, and now I can go back to my God. But that was simple, once I figured it out. It was the Larkin decision that fretted me.
Caxton said,
I think you lost your wits on that, Jubal. That silly business of letting them give Mike sovereign honors. You should simply have had Mike sign over all interest, if any, under that ridiculous Larkin theory.
Ben, my boy, Jubal said gently, as a reporter, you are sometimes readable.
Gee, thanks, my fan. But your concepts of strategy are Neanderthal.
Caxton sighed.
That's better. For a moment I thought you'd gone soft.
When I do, please shoot me.
Captain, how many men did you leave on Mars?
23.
And what is their status under the Larkin decision?
Van Tromp frowned.
I'm not supposed to talk.
Then don't, Jubal advised. We can deduce it.
Dr. Nelson said,
Skipper, Stinky and I are civilians again. I shall talk as I please.
And I, agreed Mahmood.
And they know what they can do with my reserve commission. What business is the government telling us we can't talk? Those chairwarmers didn't go to Mars.
Stowitz, Fenn, I intend to talk. These are our water brothers.
But, Ben, I would rather not see this in print.
Captain, if you'll feel easier, I'll join Mike and the girls.
Please don't leave. The government is in a stew about that colony. Every man signed away his Larkin rights to the government. Mike's presence on Mars confused things. I'm no lawyer, but I understood that if Mike did waive his rights, that would put the administration in the driver's seat when it came to parceling out things of value.
What things of value? Demanded Caxton.
Look, Skipper, I'm not running down your achievement, but from all I've heard, Mars isn't valuable real estate for human beings. Or are their assets still classified drop-dead before reading?
Van Tromp shook his head.
No, the technical reports are all declassified. But, Ben, the moon was a worthless hunk of rock when we got it.
Touché,
Caxton admitted.
I wish my grandpappy had bought Lunar Enterprises.
He added,
but Mars is inhabited.
Van Tromp looked unhappy.
Yes, but... Stinky, you tell him.
Mahmood said,
Ben, there is plenty of room on Mars for human colonization. And so far as I was able to find out, the Martians would not interfere. We're flying our flag and claiming extraterritoriality right now. But our status may be like that of one of those ant cities under glass one sees in schoolrooms. I don't know where we stand.
Jubal nodded.
Nor I. I had no idea of the situation, except that the government was anxious to get those so-called rights. So I assumed that the government was equally ignorant and went ahead. Audacity, always audacity.
Jubal grinned.
When I was in high school, I won a debate by quoting an argument from the British Colonial Shipping Board. The opposition was unable to refute me, because there never was a British Colonial Shipping Board. I was equally shameless this morning. The administration wanted Mike's Larkin rights and was scared silly that we might make a deal with somebody else. So I used their greed and worry to force that ultimate logical absurdity of their fantastic legal theory, acknowledgment in unmistakable protocol that Mike was a sovereign and must be treated accordingly.
Jubal looked smug.
Thereby, Ben said dryly, putting yourself up the well-known creek.
Ben, Jubal said chidingly. By their own logic, they had crowned Mike. Need I point out that despite the old saw about heads and crowns, it is safer to be publicly a king than a pretender in hiding? Mike's position was much improved by a few bars of music and an old sheet. But it was still not an easy one. Mike was, for the nonce, the acknowledged sovereign of Mars under the legalistic malarkey of the Larkin precedent, and empowered to hand out concessions, trading rights, enclaves ad nauseam. He must either do these things and be subjected to pressures even worse than those attendant on great wealth, or he must abdicate and allow his Larkin rights to devolve on those men now on Mars, i.e., to Douglas.
Jubal looked pained.
I've detested both alternatives. Gentlemen, I could not permit my client to be trapped into such a farce. The Larkin decision itself had to be nullified with respect to Mars, without giving the High Court a chance to rule.
Jubal grinned.
So I lied myself blue in the face to create a theory. Sovereign honors had been rendered Mike, the world had seen it. But sovereign honors may be rendered to a sovereign's alter ego, his ambassador. So I asserted that Mike was no cardboard king under a precedent not in point, but the ambassador of the great Martian nation.
Jubal shrugged.
Sheer bluff. But I was staking my bluff on my belief that others, Douglas and Kung, would be no more certain of the facts than was I.
Jubal looked around.
I risked that bluff because you three were with us, Mike's water brethren. If you did not challenge me, then Mike must be accepted as Martian ambassador. And the Larkin decision was dead.
I hope so, Captain Van Tromp said soberly. But I did not take your statements as lies, Jubal.
Eh? I was spinning fancy words, extemporizing.
No matter. I think you told the truth. The skipper of the Champion hesitated.
Except that I would not call Mike an ambassador. An invasion force is probably closer.
Caxton's jaw dropped. Harshaw answered.
In what way, sir?
Van Tromp said.
I'll amend that. I think he's a scout reconnoitering for his Martian masters. Don't mistake me, I'm as fond of the boy as you are. But there's no reason for him to be loyal to us. To Earth, I mean.
The captain frowned.
Everybody assumes that a man found on Mars would jump at the chance to go home. But it wasn't that way. Eh, Sven?
Mike hated the idea, agreed Nelson. We couldn't get close to him. He was afraid. Then the Martians told him to go with us. And he behaved like a soldier carrying out orders that scared him silly.
Just a moment, Caxton protested.
Captain, Mars invade us?
Mars?
Wouldn't that be like us attacking Jupiter? We have 2.5 times the surface gravity that Mars has. Jupiter has 2.5 times ours. Analogous differences on pressure, temperature, atmosphere, and so forth. We couldn't live on Jupiter, and I don't see how Martians could stand our conditions. Isn't that true?
Close enough, admitted Van Tromp.
Why should we attack Jupiter, or Mars attack us?
Ben, have you seen the proposals for a beachhead on Jupiter? Nothing has gone beyond the dream stage. It isn't practical. Space flight wasn't practical a few years ago. Engineers calculate that by using all we've learned from ocean exploration, plus equipping men with powered suits, it is possible to tackle Jupiter. Don't think the Martians are less clever than we are. You should see their cities.
Said Caxton. Okay. I still don't see why they would bother.
Captain.
Yes, Jubal.
I see another objection.
You know the classification of cultures into Apollonian and Dionysian?
I know in general. Well, it seems to me that even Zuni culture would be called Dionysian on Mars. You've been there. But I've been talking with Mike. That boy was raised in an Apollonian culture. Such cultures are not aggressive.
I wouldn't count on it.
Mahmood said suddenly.
Skipper, there's evidence to support Jubal. You can analyze a culture from its language, and there isn't any Martian word for war, at least I don't think there is, nor for weapon, nor fighting. If a word isn't in a language, then its culture never has the referent.
Oh, twaddle, Stinky. Animals fight, ants conduct wars. Do they have words for it?
They would have, Mahmood insisted. In any verbalizing race, a verbalizing race has words for every concept and creates new ones or new definitions whenever a new concept evolves.
A nervous system able to verbalize cannot avoid verbalizing. If the Martians know what war is, they have a word for it.
There's a way to settle it, Jubal suggested. Call in Mike.
Just a moment, Van Tromp objected. I learned years ago never to argue with a specialist, but I also learned that history is a long list of specialists who were dead wrong.
Sorry, Stinky.
You're right, Captain. Only I'm not wrong this time.
All Mike can settle is whether he knows a certain word, which might be like asking a 2-year-old to define calculus. Let's stick to facts.
Sven?
About Agnew?
Nelson answered.
It's up to you, Captain.
Well, this is among Water Brothers, gentlemen. Lieutenant Agnew was our junior medical officer. Brilliant, Sven tells me. But he couldn't stand Martians. I'd given orders against going armed once it appeared that Martians were peaceful. Agnew disobeyed me. At least we were never able to find his sidearm, and the men who saw him alive say that he was wearing it. But all my log shows is missing and presumed dead. 2 crewmen saw Agnew go into a passage between 2 large rocks. Then they saw a Martian enter the same way, whereupon they hurried, as Dr. Agnew's peculiarity was well known. Both heard a shot. One says that he reached this opening in time to glimpse Agnew past the Martian, and then he didn't see Agnew. The second man says that when he got there, the Martian was just exiting, sailed on past, and went his way. With the Martian out of the way, they could see the space between the rocks. And it was a dead end. Empty. That's all, gentlemen. Agnew might have jumped that rock wall under Mars' low gravity and the impetus of fear, but I could not, and I tried. And to mention that these crewmen were wearing breathing gear, have to on Mars, and hypoxia makes a man's senses unreliable. I don't know that the first crewman was drunk through oxygen shortage. I mention it because it is easier to believe than what he reported, which is that Agnew vanished in the blink of an eye. I suggested that he had suffered hypoxia and ordered him to check his breather gear. I thought Agnew would show up, and I was looking forward to chewing him out for going armed. But we never found him. My misgivings about Martians date to that incident. They never again seemed to be just big, gentle, harmless, rather comical creatures, even though we never had trouble, and they always gave us anything we wanted, once Stinky figured out how to ask for it. I played down the incident. Can't let men panic when you're 100 million miles from home. I couldn't play down the fact that Dr. Agnew was missing. The ship's company searched for him, but I squelched any suggestion of anything mysterious. Agnew got lost among those rocks, died when his oxygen ran out, was buried under sand drift. I used it to clamp down on always traveling in company, staying in radio contact, checking breather gear. I did not tell that crewman to keep his mouth shut. I simply hinted that his story was ridiculous, since his mate did not confirm it. I think the official version prevailed. Mahmood said slowly,
Captain, this is the first I've heard that there was any mystery. And I prefer your official version. I'm not superstitious.
Van Tromp nodded. That's what I wanted. Only Sven and myself heard that wild tale. But just the same.
The captain suddenly looked old.
I wake up in the night and ask myself, what became of Agnew?
Jubal listened without comment. Had Jill told Ben about Berquist and that other fellow, Johnson? Had anyone told Ben about the Battle of the Swimming Pool? It seemed unlikely. The kids knew that the official version was that the first task force had never showed up. They had all heard his phone call with Douglas. Damn it, the only course was to keep quiet and keep on trying to impress the boy that he must not make unpleasant strangers disappear. Jubal was saved from further soul-searching by Anne's arrival.
Boss, Mr. Bradley is at the door, the one who called himself senior executive assistant to the Secretary General.
You didn't let him in?
No, we talked through the speakeasy. He says he has papers to deliver to you and that he will wait for an answer.
Have him pass them through the flap. This is still the Martian embassy.
Just let him stand outside?
And I know you were gently reared, but this is a situation in which rudeness pays off. We don't give an inch until we get what we want.
Yes, boss.
The package was bulky with copies. There was only one document. Jubal called in everyone and passed them around.
I'm offering one lollipop for each loophole, booby trap, or ambiguity.
Presently, Jubal broke the silence.
He's an honest politician. He stays bought.
Looks that way, admitted Caxton.
Anybody?
No one claimed a prize. Douglas had merely implemented the agreement.
Okay, said Jubal. Everybody witness every copy. Get your seal, Miriam. Hell, let Bradley in and have him witness, too. Then give him a drink. Duke, tell the desk we're checking out. Call Greyhound and get our go-buggy. Sven, Skipper, Stinky, we're leaving the way Lot left Sodom. Why don't you come up in the country and relax? Plenty of beds, home cooking, no worries.
The married men asked for rain checks. Dr. Mahmood accepted. The signing took rather long because Mike enjoyed signing his name, drawing each letter with artistic satisfaction. The remains of the picnic had been loaded by the time all copies were signed and sealed, and the hotel bill had arrived. Jubal glanced at the fat total, wrote on it, "Approved for payment. J. Harshaw for V.M. Smith," and handed it to Bradley.
"This is your boss's worry."
Bradley blinked.
"Sir?"
"Oh, Mr. Douglas will doubtless turn it over to the chief of protocol. I'm rather green about these things."
Bradley accepted the bill.
"Yes," he said slowly. "LaRue will voucher it. I'll give it to him."
"Thank you, Mr. Bradley. For everything."
Part 3. His Eccentric Education. Chapter 22. In one limb of a spiral galaxy, close to a star known as Sol, to some, another star became Nova. Its glory would be seen on Mars in 3 replenished, 729 years, or 1,370 Terran years. The old ones noted it as useful, shortly, for instruction of the young, while never ceasing the exciting discussion of aesthetic problems concerning the new epic woven around the death of the fifth planet. The departure of the champion they noted without comment. A watch was kept on the strange nestling sent back in it, but nothing more since there would be waiting before it would be fruitful to grok the outcome. The humans left on Mars struggled with environment lethal to naked humans, but less difficult than that in the Free State of Antarctica. One discorporated through an illness, sometimes called homesickness. The old ones cherished the wounded spirit and sent it where it belonged for further healing. Aside from that, Martians left Terrans alone. On Earth, the exploding star was not noticed, human astronomers then being limited by speed of light. The man from Mars was briefly in the news. The Federation Senate Minority Leader called for a bold new approach to problems of population and malnutrition in Southeast Asia, starting with increasing grants and aid to families with more than 5 children. Mrs. Percy B.S. Suchek sued the Los Angeles City County Supervisors over the death of her pet poodle Piddle, which had taken place during a 5-day stationary inversion. Cynthia Duchess announced that she was going to have the perfect baby by a scientifically selected donor and an equally perfect host mother, as soon as experts completed calculating the instant for conception to ensure that the wonder child would be equally a genius in music, art, and statesmanship, and that she would, with the aid of hormonal treatments, nurse the child herself. She gave an interview on the psychological benefits of natural feeding and insisted, that the press take pictures to prove that she was endowed for this. Supreme Bishop Digby denounced her as the harlot of Babylon and forbade any fosterite to accept the commission, either as donor or host mother. Alice Douglas was quoted, "While I do not know Miss Duchess, one cannot help but admire her. Her brave example should be an inspiration to mothers everywhere." Jubal Harshaw saw one of her pictures in a magazine. He posted it in the kitchen, then noted that it did not stay up long, which made him chuckle. He did not have many chuckles that week. The world was too much with him. The press ceased bothering Mike when the story was over, but thousands of people did not forget Mike. Douglas tried to ensure Mike's privacy. SS troopers patrolled Harshaw's fence, and an SS car circled overhead and challenged any car that tried to land. Harshaw resented needing guards. The telephone Jubal routed through an answering service, to which was given a short list from whom Harshaw would accept calls, and kept the house instrument on refuse and record most of the time. But mail always comes through. Harshaw told Jill that Mike had to grow up. He could start by handling his mail. She could help him.
"But don't bother me. I have enough screwball mail."
Jubal could not make it stick. There was too much, and Jill did not know how. Just sorting was a headache. Jubal called the local postmaster, which got no results, then called Bradley, which caused a suggestion to trickle down. Thereafter, Mike's mail arrived sacked as first, second, third, and fourth class, with mail for everyone else in another sack. Second and third class was used to insulate a root cellar. Once the cellar was over-insulated, Jubal told Duke to use such mail to check erosion in gullies. Fourth-class mail was a problem. One package exploded in the village post office, blowing down several years of wanted announcements, and one "Use Next Window" sign. By luck, the postmaster was out for coffee, and his assistant, an elderly lady with weak kidneys, was in the washroom. Jubal considered having parcels processed by bomb specialists. This turned out not to be necessary. Mike could spot a wrongness about a package without opening it. Thereafter, fourth-class mail was left at the gate. Mike pried through it from a distance, caused to disappear any harmful parcel. Larry trucked the remainder to the house. Mike loved opening packages, although the plunder might not interest him. Anything nobody wanted wound up in a gully. This included gifts of food. As Jubal was not certain that Mike's nose for wrongness extended to poisons. Mike had drunk a poisonous solution used for photography, which Duke had left in the refrigerator. Mike said mildly that the iced tea had a flavor he was not sure he liked. Jubal told Jill that it was all right to keep anything, provided nothing was A. paid for, B. acknowledged, nor C. returned, no matter how marked. Some items were gifts. More was unordered merchandise. Either way, Jubal assumed that unsolicited chattels represented efforts to use the man from Mars, and merited no thanks. An exception was livestock, which Jubal advised Jill to return, unless she guaranteed care and feeding, and keeping same from falling into the pool. First-class mail was the biggest headache. After looking over a bushel or so, Jubal set up categories. A. Begging letters. Erosion fill. B. Threatening letters. File unanswered. Later letters from same source turn over to SS. C. Business opportunities. Forward to Douglas. D. Crackpot letters. Pass around any dillies, the rest to a gully. E. Friendly letters. Answer, if accompanied by stamped, self-addressed envelope, using form letters signed by Jill. Jubal pointed out that letters signed by the man from Mars were valuable, and an invitation to more useless mail. F. Scatological letters. Pass to Jubal, who had a bet with himself that none would show the faintest literary novelty, for disposition, i.e. gully. G. Proposals of marriage, and propositions less formal. File. H. Letters from scientific and educational institutions. Handle as under E. If answered, use form letter explaining that the man from Mars was not available for anything. If Jill felt that a brush-off would not do, pass to Jubal. I. Letters from persons who knew Mike, such as the crew of the Champion, the President of the United States, and others. Let Mike answer as he pleased. Exercise in penmanship would be good, and exercise in human relations even better. If he wanted advice, let him ask. This cut the answers to a few for Jill, seldom even one for Mike. Jill found that she could skim and classify in about 1 hour each day. The first four categories remained large. Category G was very large following the stereocast from the palace, then dwindled. Jubal cautioned Jill that while Mike should answer letters only from acquaintances, mail addressed to him was his. The third morning after the system was installed, Jill brought a letter, category G, to Jubal. The ladies and other females, plus misguided males, who supplied this category usually included pictures alleged to be of themselves. Some left little to the imagination. This letter enclosed a picture which left nothing to the imagination, then stimulated fresh imaginings. Jill said, "Look at this, boss. I ask you." Jubal read the letter.
"She knows what she wants. What does Mike think?"
"He hasn't seen it." Jubal glanced at the picture.
"A type which in my youth we called stacked. Well, her sex is not in doubt, nor her agility. Why show it to me? I've seen better."
"What should I do? The letter is bad enough, but that disgusting picture. Should I tear it up?"
What's on the envelope?
Just the address and return address.
How does the address read?
Huh? Mr. Valentine Michael Smith, the man from...
Oh! Then it's not addressed to you.
Why, no, of course...
Let's get something straight. You are neither Mike's mother nor his chaperone. If Mike wants to read everything addressed to him, including junk mail, he is free to do so.
He does read most of those ads. But you don't want him to see filth. He's innocent.
So, how many men has he killed?
Jill looked unhappy.
Jubal went on.
If you want to help him, you will concentrate on teaching him that killing is frowned on in this society. Otherwise, he will be conspicuous when he goes out into the world.
I don't think he wants to go out into the world.
I'm going to push him out of the nest as soon as he can fly. I shan't make it possible for him to live out his life as an arrested infant. For one thing, I can't. Mike will outlive me by many years. But you are correct. Mike is innocent. Nurse, have you seen that sterile laboratory at Notre Dame?
I've read about it.
Healthiest animals in the world. But they can't leave the laboratory. Child, Mike has got to get acquainted with filth and get immunized. Someday he'll meet the gal who wrote this or her spiritual sisters. He'll meet her by the hundreds. Shucks, with his notoriety and looks, he could spend his life skipping from one bed to another. You can't stop it, I can't stop it. It's up to Mike. Furthermore, I wouldn't want to stop it. Although it's a silly way to spend one's life. The same exercises over and over again, I mean. What do you think?
Jill blushed.
Maybe you don't find the monotonous none of my business either way. But if you don't want Mike's feet kicked out from under him by the first 500 women who get him alone, then don't interrupt his mail. Letters like that may put him on guard. Just pass it along in the stack, answer his questions, and try not to blush.
Boss, you're infuriating when you're logical.
A most uncouth way to argue.
I'm going to tear up that picture after Mike has seen it.
Oh, don't do that.
What? Do you want it?
Heaven forbid. But Duke collects such pictures. If Mike doesn't want to give it to Duke.
Duke collects such trash? He seems such a nice person.
He is.
But I don't understand.
Jubal sighed.
I could explain it all day and you still wouldn't. My dear, there are aspects of sex on which it is impossible to communicate between the two sexes of our race. They are sometimes grokked by intuition across the gulf that separates us, by exceptionally gifted individuals. But words are useless. Just believe me, Duke is a perfect knight, and he will like that picture.
I won't hand it to Duke myself. He might get ideas.
Sissy. Anything startling in the mail?
No. The usual crop who want Mike to endorse things or peddle official man from Mars junk. One character asked for a 5-year royalty-free monopoly and wants Mike to finance it, too.
I admire a wholehearted thief. Tell him that Mike needs tax losses, so how much guarantee would he like?
Are you serious, boss?
No, the Goniff would show up with his family. But you've given me an idea for a story. Front!
Mike was interested in the disgusting picture. He grokked, theoretically, what the letter and picture symbolized, and studied the picture with the delight with which he studied each butterfly. He found butterflies and women tremendously interesting. All the grokking world was enchanting, and he wanted to drink so deep that his own grokking would be perfect. He understood the mechanical and biological processes being offered in these letters, but wondered why strangers wanted his help in quickening eggs. Mike knew, without grokking, that these people made ritual of this necessity, a growing closer, somewhat like water ceremony. He was eager to grok it. But he was not in a hurry. Hurry, he failed to grok. He was sensitive to correct timing, but with Martian approach. Timing was accomplished by waiting. He noticed that his human brothers lacked his discrimination of time and often were forced to wait faster than a Martian would. But he did not hold their awkwardness against them. He learned to wait faster to cover their lack. He sometimes waited faster so efficiently that a human would have concluded that he was hurrying at breakneck speed. He accepted Jill's edict that he was not to reply to these brotherly offers from female humans, but accepted it as a waiting. Possibly a century hence would be better. In any case, now was not the time, since his brother Jill spoke rightly. Mike agreed when Jill suggested that he give this picture to Duke. He would have anyhow. Mike had seen Duke's collection, looked through it with interest. Trying to grok why, Duke said,
"That one ain't much in the face, but look at those legs. Brother!"
It made Mike feel good to be called brother by one of his own. But legs were legs, save that his people had three each while humans had only two. Without being crippled, he reminded himself. As for faces, Jubal had the most beautiful face Mike had ever seen, distinctly his own. These human females in Duke's picture collection could hardly be said to have faces. All young human females had the same face. How could it be otherwise? He had never had trouble recognizing Jill's face. She was the first woman he had ever seen and his first female water brother. Mike knew every pore on her nose, every incipient wrinkle in her face, and had praised each one in happy meditation. But while he now knew Anne from Dorcas, and Dorcas from Miriam, by faces, it had not been so at first. Mike had distinguished by size and coloration, and by voice, since voices were never alike. When, as sometimes did happen, all three females were quiet at once, it was well that Anne was so much bigger, Dorcas so small, and that Miriam, bigger than Dorcas but smaller than Anne, nevertheless need not be mistaken for another if Anne or Dorcas was absent. Because Miriam had hair called red, even though it was not the color called red when speaking of anything but hair. Mike knew that every English word held more than one meaning. It was a fact one got used to, just as the sameness of girl faces one could get used to. And after waiting, they were no longer the same. Mike now could call up Anne's face and count the pores in her nose as readily as Jill's. In essence, even an egg was uniquely self, different from all other eggs, anywhere and when. So each girl had potentially her own face, no matter how small the difference. Mike gave the picture to Duke, and was warmed by Duke's pleasure. Mike was not depriving himself. He could see it in his mind whenever he wished. Even the face, as it had glowed with an unusual expression of beautiful pain. He accepted Duke's thanks, and went happily back to his mail. Mike did not share Jubal's annoyance at the postal avalanche. He reveled in it. Insurance ads and marriage proposals. His trip to the palace had opened his eyes to enormous variety in this world, and he resolved to grok it all. It would take centuries, and he must grow and grow and grow, but he was in no hurry. He grokked that eternity and the ever-beautifully changing now were identical. He decided not to reread the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mail gave him brighter glimpses of the world. He read it, grokked what he could, remembered the rest for contemplation while the household slept. He was beginning, he thought, to grok, business, buying, selling, and related on Martian activities. The encyclopedia had left him unfilled, as he now grokked. Each article had assumed that he knew things that he did not. There arrived in the mail, from Secretary General Joseph Edgerton Douglas, a checkbook and papers. His brother Jubal took pains to explain what money was and how it was used. Mike failed to understand, even though Jubal showed him how to make out a check, gave him money in exchange for it, taught him to count it. Then suddenly, with grokking so blinding that he trembled, he understood money. These pretty pictures and bright medallions were not money. They were symbols for an idea which spread through these people, all through their world. But things were not money, any more than water shared was growing closer. Money was an idea, as abstract as an old one's thoughts. Money was a great structured symbol for balancing and healing and growing closer. Mike was dazzled with the magnificent beauty of money. The flow and change and countermarching of symbols was beautiful in small, reminding him of games taught nestlings to encourage them to reason and grow. But it was the totality that dazzled him, an entire world reflected in one dynamic symbol structure. Mike then grokked that the old ones of this race were very old indeed to have composed such beauty. He wished humbly to be allowed to meet one. Jubal encouraged him to spend money, and Mike did so, with the timid eagerness of a bride being brought to bed. Jubal suggested that he buy presents for friends, and Jill helped, starting by placing limits, one per friend, and a total cost, not even a reciprocal filled three of the sum in his account. Mike had intended to spend all. He learned how difficult it was to spend money. There were so many things, all wonderful and incomprehensible. Surrounded by catalogs from Marshall Field's and the Ginza, Bombay and Copenhagen, he felt smothered in riches. Even the Sears and Montgomery catalog was too much. Jill helped.
No, Duke would not want a tractor.
Duke likes tractors.
He's got one, or Jubal has, which is the same thing. He might like one of those cute little Belgian unicycles. He could take it apart and put it together all day long. But even that is too expensive. Mike, dear, a present ought not to be expensive. Unless you are trying to get a girl to marry you, or something. A present should show that you consider that person's tastes. Something he would enjoy, but probably would not buy.
How?
That's the problem. Wait, I just remembered something in this morning's mail.
She was back quickly.
Found it!
Listen to this. Living Aphrodite, a deluxe album of feminine beauty in gorgeous stereo color by the world's greatest artists of the camera. Notice this item cannot be mailed. Orders cannot be accepted from addresses in the following states. Pennsylvania's on the list. But we'll find a way. For if I know Duke's tastes, this is what he likes.
It was delivered via SS patrol car. And the next ad boasted, as supplied to the man from Mars by special appointment. Which pleased Mike and annoyed Jill.
Picking a present for Jubal stumped Jill. What does one buy for a man who has everything he wants that money can buy? Three wishes? The fountain that Ponce de Leon failed to find? Oil for his ancient bones? Or one golden day of youth? Jubal had long forsworn pets because he outlived them. Or, worse yet, it was now possible that a pet would outlive him, be orphaned. They consulted others.
Shucks, Duke told them. Didn't you know? The boss likes statues.
Really?
Jill answered. I don't see any sculpture around.
The stuff he likes mostly isn't for sale. He says the crud they make nowadays looks like disaster in a junkyard. Any idiot with a blowtorch and astigmatism calls himself a sculptor. Anne nodded.
Duke is right. You can tell by looking at books in Jubal's study.
Anne picked out three books as bearing evidence to her eyes of having been looked at most often. She said.
The boss likes anything by Rodin.
Mike, if you could buy one of these, which would you pick? Here's a pretty one, Eternal Springtime. Mike glanced at it and turned pages. This one.
What?
Jill shuddered.
Mike, that's dreadful. I hope I die long before I look like that.
That is beauty, Mike said firmly.
Mike,
Jill protested. You've got a depraved taste. You're worse than Duke. Ordinarily, such a rebuke, especially from Jill, would shut Mike up, force him to spend the night in trying to grok his fault. But in this he was sure of himself. The portrayed figure felt like a breath of home. Although it pictured a human woman, it gave him a feeling that a Martian old one should be near, responsible for its creation.
It is beauty, he insisted. She has her own face. I grok.
Jill,
Anne said slowly.
Mike is right.
Huh?
Anne? Surely you don't like that? It frightens me. But the book falls open in three places. This page has been handled more than the other two. This other one, the caryatid fallen under her stone, Jubal looks at almost as often. But Mike's choice is Jubal's pet.
I buy it, Mike said decisively.
Anne telephoned the Rodin Museum in Paris, and only Gallic gallantry kept them from laughing. Sell? One of the master's works, my dear lady, they are not only not for sale, but may not be reproduced. Non, 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 quelle idée! But for the man from Mars, unlikely things are possible. Anne called Bradley. 2 days later, he called back. As a compliment from the French government, with a request that the present never be exhibited, Mike would receive a full-size, microscopically exact bronze photopantogram of She Who Used to Be the Beautiful Olmière. Jill helped select presents for the girls.
But when Mike asked what he should buy for her, she insisted that he not buy anything. Mike was beginning to realize that while Water Brothers spoke rightly, sometimes they spoke more rightly than others. He consulted Anne.
She has to tell you that, dear, but you give her a present anyhow.
Anne selected one which puzzled him. Jill already smelled the way Jill should smell. When the present arrived, its size and apparent unimportance added to his misgivings. And when Anne had him with it before giving it to Jill, Mike was more in doubt than ever. The odor was very strong, and not at all like Jill. Jill was delighted with the perfume, and insisted on kissing him at once. In kissing her, he grokked that this gift was what she wanted, and that it made them grow closer. When she wore it at dinner that night, he discovered that in some unclear fashion, it made Jill smell more deliciously Jill than ever. Still stranger, it caused Dorcas to kiss him and whisper, "Mycon, the negligee is just lovely, but perhaps someday you'll give me perfume?" Mike could not grok why Dorcas would want it. Dorcas did not smell like Jill, so perfume would not be proper for her. Nor would he want Dorcas to smell like Jill. He wanted Dorcas to smell like Dorcas. Jubal interrupted.
"Quit nuzzling the lad and let him eat. Dorcas, you reek like a Marseille cat house. Don't wheedle Mike for more, stinkum."
"Boss, mind your own business."
It was puzzling that Jill could smell still more like Jill. But Dorcas should wish to smell like Jill when she smelled like herself. That Jubal would say that Dorcas smelled like a cat. There was a cat on the place, not a pet, but co-owner. On occasion it came to the house and deigned to accept a handout. The cat and Mike grokked each other. Mike found its carnivorous thoughts most pleasing and quite Martian. He discovered that the cat's name, Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, was not the cat's name, but he had not told anyone because he could not pronounce the cat's real name. He could only hear it in his head. The cat did not smell like Dorcas. Giving presents was a great goodness, and taught Mike the true value of money. But he did not forget other things he was eager to grok. Jubal put off Senator Boone twice without mentioning it, and Mike did not notice. His grasp of time made next Sunday no particular date. But the next invitation came addressed to Mike. Boone was under pressure from Supreme Bishop Digby, and sensed that Harshaw was stalling. Mike took it to Jubal.
"Well," Jubal growled, "do you want to go? You don't have to. We can tell him to go to hell."
A checker cab with a human pilot, Harshaw refused to trust a robo-cab called next Sunday morning to deliver Mike, Jill, and Jubal to the Archangel Foster Tabernacle of the Church of the New Revelation. Chapter 23. All the way to church, Jubal was trying to warn Mike. Of what, Mike was not certain. He listened, but the landscape tugged for attention. He compromised by storing what Jubal said.
"Look, boy," Jubal admonished, "these Fosterites are after your money, and the prestige of having the man from Mars join their church. They'll work on you. You'll have to be firm."
"Beg pardon?"
"Damn it, you're not listening."
"I am sorry, Jubal."
"Well, look at it this way. Religion is a solace to many, and it is conceivable that some religion somewhere is ultimate truth. But being religious is often a form of conceit. The faith in which I was brought up assured me that I was better than other people. I was saved, they were damned. We were in a state of grace, and the rest were heathens. By heathen, they meant such as our brother Mahmud. Ignorant louts who seldom bathed and planted corn by the moon claimed to know the final answers of the universe. That entitled them to look down on outsiders. Our hymns were loaded with arrogance, self-congratulation on how cozy we were with the Almighty and what high opinion he had of us. What hell everybody else would catch some judgment day. We peddled the only authentic brand of Lydia Pinkham's..."
"Jubal," Jill protested, "he doesn't grok it."
Sorry. My folks tried to make a preacher of me. I guess it shows."
"It does."
"Don't scoff, girl. It would have made a good one if I hadn't fallen into the fatal folly of reading. With a touch more confidence and a liberal helping of ignorance, I would have been a famous evangelist. Shucks, this place we're headed for would be known as Archangel Jubal Tabernacle."
Jill shuddered.
"Jubal, please. Not so soon after breakfast."
"I mean it.
A confidence man knows he's lying. That limits his scope. But a successful shaman believes what he says, and belief is contagious. There's no limit to his scope. But I lacked the necessary confidence in my own infallibility. I could never become a prophet, just a critic. A sort of fourth-rate prophet with delusions of gender.
Jubal frowned. That's what worries me about Fosterites, Jill. I think they are sincere. Mike is a sucker for sincerity.
What do you think they'll try to do?
Convert him. Then get the hands on his fortune.
I thought you had things fixed so that nobody could.
No, just so that nobody can grab it against his will. Ordinarily, he couldn't give it away without the government stepping in. But giving it to a politically powerful church is another matter.
I don't see why.
Jubal scowled.
My dear, religion is a null area in the law. A church can do anything any organization can do, and has no restrictions. It pays no taxes, need not publish records, is effectively immune to search, inspection, or control, and a church is anything that calls itself a church. Attempts have been made to distinguish between real religions entitled to immunities and cults. It can't be done, short of establishing a state religion, a cure worse than the disease. Both under what's left of the United States Constitution and under the Treaty of Federation, all churches are equally immune, especially if they swing a block of votes. If Mike is converted to Fosterism and makes a will in favor of his church, then goes to heaven, some sunrise, it will be in the correct tautology, as legal as church on Sunday.
Oh, dear, I thought we had him safe at last.
There is no safety this side of the grave.
Well, what are you going to do, Jubal?
Nothing. Just fret.
Mike stored their conversation without trying to grok it. He recognized the subject as one of utter simplicity in his own language, but amazingly slippery in English. Since his failure to achieve mutual grokking, even with his brother Mahmud, through imperfect translation of the all-embracing Martian concept as Thou Art God, he had waited. Waiting would fructify at its time. His brother Jill was learning his language, and he would explain it to her. They would grok together.
Senator Boone met them at the Tabernacle's landing flat.
Howdy, folks. May the good Lord bless you this beautiful Sabbath. Mr. Smith, I'm happy to see you again. And you too, Doctor.
He took his cigar out of his mouth and looked at Jill.
And this little lady, didn't I see you at the palace?
Yes, Senator. I'm Jillian Boardman.
Thought so, my dear. Are you saved?
I guess not, Senator.
It's never too late. We'll be happy to have you attend Seeker Service in the Outer Tabernacle. I'll find a guardian to guide you. Mr. Smith and the Doc will be going into the sanctuary.
Senator.
What, Doc? If Miss Baldwin can't go into the sanctuary, we had better attend Seeker's Service. She's his nurse.
Boone looked perturbed.
Is he ill?
Jubal shrugged.
As his physician, I prefer to have a nurse with us. Mr. Smith is not acclimated to this planet. Why don't you ask him? Mike, do you want Jill with you?
Yes, Jubal.
But... Very well, Mr. Smith.
Boone again removed his cigar, put fingers between his lips, and whistled.
Cherub here!
A youngster in his teens came dashing up. He was dressed in short full robe, tight slippers, and pigeon's wings. He had golden curls and a sunny smile. Jill thought he was as cute as a ginger ale ad. Boone ordered,
Fly up to the sanctum office and tell the warden on duty that I want another pilgrim's badge at the sanctuary gate right away. The word is Mars.
Mars, the kid repeated, threw Boone a scout salute, and made a 60-foot leap over the crowd. Jill realized why the robe looked bulky. It concealed a jump harness.
Have to watch those badges, Boone remarked. Be surprised how many sinners would like to sample God's joy without having their sins washed away. We'll mosey along and sightsee while we wait for the third badge.
They pushed through the crowd and entered the tabernacle into a long, high hall. Boone stopped.
I want you to notice, there is salesmanship in everything, even the Lord's work. Any tourist, whether he attends Seeker Service or not, and services run 24 hours a day, has to come through here. What does he see? These happy chances.
Boone waved at slot machines lining both walls.
The bar and quick lunch is at the far end. He can't even get a drink without running this gauntlet. I tell you, it's a remarkable sinner who gets that far without shedding his change.
But we don't take his money and give him nothing.
Take a look.
Boone shouldered his way to a machine, tapped the woman playing it.
Please, daughter.
She looked up. Annoyance changed to a smile.
Certainly, Bishop.
Bless you.
You'll note, Boone went on as he fed a quarter into the machine,
that whether it pays off in worldly goods or not, a sinner is rewarded with a blessing and a souvenir text.
The machine stopped. Lined up in the window was God, watches, you.
That pays 3 for 1,
Boone said, and fished the payoff out of the receptacle.
And here's your text.
He tore off a paper tab and handed it to Jill.
Keep it, little lady, and ponder it.
Jill sneaked a glance before putting it into her purse. But the sinner's belly is filled with filth. NR 22:17.
You'll note, Boone went on, that the payoff is tokens, not cash, and the bursar's cage is back past the bar. Plenty of opportunity there to make love offerings for charity and other good works, so the sinner probably feeds them back in, with a blessing each time, and another text. The cumulative effect is tremendous. Why, some of our most faithful sheep got their start right in this room.
I don't doubt it,
agreed Jubal.
Especially if they hit a jackpot. You understand, every combination is a blessing, but the jackpot, that's the 3 holy eyes, I tell you, when they see those eyes lined up and staring at them. All that manna from heaven coming down, it really makes them think. Sometimes they faint.
Here, Mr. Smith. Boone offered Mike one of the tokens. Give it a whirl. Mike hesitated. Jubal took the token himself. Damn it, he didn't want the boy hooked by a one-armed bandit.
I'll try it, Senator.
He fed the machine. Mike had extended his time sense a little and was feeling around inside the machine, trying to discover what it did. He was too timid to play it himself. But when Jubal did so, Mike watched the cylinders spin, noted the eye pictured on each, and wondered what this jackpot was. The word had 3 meanings, so far as he knew. None of them seemed to apply. Without intending to cause excitement, he slowed and stopped each wheel so that the eyes looked out through the window. A bell tolled, a choir sang hosannas, the machine lighted up and started spewing slugs. Boone looked delighted.
Well, bless you, Doc, this is your day. Here, put one back to take the jackpot off.
He picked up one of the flood and fed it back in. Mike was wondering why this was happening, so he lined up the eyes again. Events repeated, save that the flood was a trickle. Boone stared.
Well, I'll be blessed. It's not supposed to hit 2 in a row. But I'll see that you're paid on both.
Quickly, he put a slug back in. Mike still wanted to see why this was a jackpot. The eyes lined up again. Boone stared. Jill squeezed Mike's hand and whispered, Mike, stop it.
But Jill, I was saying,
don't talk, just stop. Oh, wait till I get you home.
Boone said slowly,
I'd hesitate to call this a miracle. Probably needs a repairman.
He shouted, Cherub here,
and added, we'd better take the last one off anyhow,
and fed in another slug. Without Mike's intercession, the wheels slowed down and announced, Foster loves you. A cherub came up and said,
Happy day, you need help?
3 jackpots, Boone told him.
3?
Didn't you hear the music, are you deaf? We'll be at the bar, fetch the money here, and have somebody check this machine.
Yes, Bishop.
Boone hurried them to the bar.
Gotta get you out of here, he said jovially, before you bankrupt the church.
Doc, are you always that lucky?
Always, Harshaw said solemnly.
He told himself that he did not know that the boy had anything to do with it. But he wished that this ordeal were over. Boone took them to a counter marked reserved and said,
This'll do, or would the little lady like to sit?
This is fine.
And you call me a little lady once more, and I'll turn Mike loose on you. A bartender hurried up.
Happy day, your usual Bishop. Double. Will it be, Doc? And Mr. Smith, don't be bashful. You're the Supreme Bishop's guests. Brandy, thank you. Water on the side.
Brandy, thank you, Mike repeated, and added, No water for me, please. Water was not the essence. Nevertheless, he did not wish to drink water here.
That's the spirit, Boone said heartily. That's the spirit with spirits, no water. Get it? It's a joke.
He dug Jubal in the ribs.
What'll it be for the little lady? Cola? Milk for your rosy cheeks?
or a real happy day drink with the big folks.
Senator, Jill said carefully, would your hospitality extend to a martini?
Would it? Best martinis in the world. We don't use vermouth. We bless them instead.